If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
It's the same reason I think you start with like a single family house instead of buy an apartment complex out of the gate. I feel, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So if you start small, you're minimizing your risk.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jeff Holst is a recovering attorney, a full-time real estate investor with more than 300 residential units and several commercial properties. He is co-host of the Old Fashioned Real Estate Show, where they mix bourbon, old fashions, and real estate investing. I want to be invited to that, by the way. He is also the co-host and founder of the Last Life Ever podcast and is passionate about helping people live the best life possible, or the best life. He is also the co-host. What's that?
I said, it's close enough, man.
Close enough.
The best version of your last life ever. That's what we always say.
Oh, hey, man. You know, maybe we'll just keep this one. I just butchered your intro.
That's fine. It happens all the time. I make it really complicated with all these different moving parts and stuff.
Yeah, normally I'd go back and re-record it, but let's just leave this as it is. And maybe I just want to come to the bourbon part of your show. I think that's the part of the show I want to be invited to.
It sounds
to.
Like you might have already had some bourbon.
No, sir. It's 2 in the afternoon and we got a full work day yet ahead. But I appreciate the invite. Jeff, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Sure. So I was a bankruptcy attorney. I always thought I would invest in real estate someday. I didn't get around to it right away. And then I was diagnosed with leukemia. So I got diagnosed with leukemia in 2008, and it actually forced me into personal bankruptcy. So that was kind of embarrassing as a bankruptcy attorney. And after that, I was like, wow, I might die. I better figure out a way to get income if I'm not alive. And the only thing I knew of that would work was real estate, because, you know, they just keep paying even if you're dead.
You might die, so you want to get income in case you die? Is that how that went?
Yeah, well, it was income for my wife, right? Like, it wasn't really okay for me at that point. You know, I want to support my family. And I knew that, like, I couldn't practice law if I was sick and potentially dying. And so what I did is, as soon as I was healthy enough to get back to work, I took a job in Tennessee. That's how I ended up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Moved down here. And I took all the money I got from bonuses and bought real estate in Michigan, in Detroit. And, you know, the timing was excellent. It was 2010 when I started doing that. And so it's worked out really well. I would like to say it was like, I'm like a soothsayer or something, but like, no, just got lucky on the timing of that. Although I'm not sure most people would consider getting leukemia and thinking you're going to die a lucky break. But for me, that's really how it worked out. So,
yeah, no, that's not on my short list. Sorry.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't recommend it.
No. Well, I'm glad that you kicked that and then turn around and figure out how to do real estate. So what are you investing in now? I mean, were you investing in single family in Michigan or what?
Yeah. So when we first started, what happened is I'd saved up about $20,000 and there was a condo in Rochester, Michigan, which is a ritzy suburb of Detroit. Was foreclosed on. The bank had a mortgage of $105,000 and the bank was selling it for $30,000. So my buddy and I bought it for cash. So that was how we started. We bought a couple condos that way. Then I was out of money, didn't have any credit because I just filed bankruptcy. So we started doing some private money stuff. And then we just started, doing more of that. And then we just kept reinvesting every dollar that we got. We didn't take any money out for 7 years. So 2010 to 2017, we just reinvested everything. And then in 2017, I quit my job and just went full-time real estate after that. And that's when we started doing apartments and things like that. Before, we just did single family and duplexes.
Right. So in 2017, you guys decided to then start moving into apartments.
Yeah, actually, I thought I could just quit and like go to the beach and hang out for the rest of my life at 37 years old. And I decided, hey, you know, I've got this freedom. But it turns out after about a week and a half, I was bored. And I was like, I gotta do something else. So we came up with this idea to start a real estate show. You know, I started looking at apartment complexes, and I was actually drunk one day at Ruth Chris and drinking old fashions with a friend of mine. And I said, you know, we should have a real estate show, and we'll just call it Old Fashioned Real Estate because it'll be funny.
Wow. Okay. I mean, man, your story is like a ping ball or a pinball machine where you just kind of go, wait, what happened? How did that? Yeah.
Well, there's a little more to it, but you know, short format show, you know, Sam, I got to do it quick.
Absolutely. Quick, no, I love it. I love it. So you guys, why did you transition from residential units? You said you had 300 residential units at one point.
No, we have that now. Then we had about 55 or so units, but almost all single family with a few duplexes mixed in, and almost all free and clear, because these were ones we were buying in Detroit for, you know, $5,000, $10,000. And then we would refinance them. And what we were doing back then is we would fix them up. We would then put a tenant in paying $700 or $800 a month. And then we would sell them actually to out of country investors and keep a management. So kind of like a turnkey system, but not really. And we would sell them, you know, at like an 8 cap, and they were super happy with it. And we were getting, you know, what we thought were very far above market prices. And then every third or fourth house, we would keep one for ourselves that we liked, you know, the better neighborhood, whatever. And so we ended up with a nice little portfolio that was completely financed out of that strategy. Plus some, like I said, some private money. But what we did there is we had a guy who was loaning us money at 6% interest only. And we were partnered with him. So he would get a piece of the deal plus the 6% interest. And then we would pay off the interest to him. And then we'd pay off the loans to him. And the rest, other than whatever we owed our one partner, it was all free and clear. So.
Wow. Now that's super cool. That's super cool. But then you moved on from that into smaller multifamily buildings.
Yeah. So when I left my job, I got a severance that was like 60,000 or 50,000, something like that. It was a little bit of cash. I didn't have a ton of cash, but I figured I could figure it out. So I flipped a duplex, made a little bit more cash. And then I said to my dad, hey, we should buy this, this 12 unit building, because it seems like a good investment. And I didn't have enough money. So I split it with him. And actually, we're selling it now. So that was my first apartment complex, and it's under contract to sell now, about a $550,000 profit in 3 years. So can't really argue with that, right? It was 140 down, right? $640,000 purchase price.
Wow. Wow. And do you feel like that's a strategy that you can continue to wash, rinse, repeat?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really like selling stuff, but in this case, the market's goofy and it's the smallest deal we own. So most of our deals are bigger than that. Mm. So I was like, yeah, I'll just sell it, take the cash, redeploy it somewhere else. But yeah, I mean, we've done that. The other deals we've done since then have been similar value add deals. We bought them, fixed them up a little bit, raised the rent, stabilized them, and then refinanced them, pulled out our cash. So like the most recent refinance we did was on a 41 unit up in Michigan. And we got all of our money out plus a little bit after 18 months. Wow. It's still cash flowing like at a 1.8 debt coverage ratio, even after the refinance.
Holy smokes. That's amazing.
Yeah. Actually, we left a ton of equity in, but the bank was like, oh, you've only owned it 18 months. Like, we're going to cap your loan at 2 million. So we could have pulled out probably 2.6, 2.7 if it wasn't for that cap.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. So what's the largest unit you own, number of doors?
Yeah, the 41 units, the largest we've done. Most of ours are 20 to 30 units is what we kind of sweet spot for us.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of competition, right? If you get $1 million loan balance, you scare away the mom and pop people. And the big syndicators, they're going after 100 unit plus 75, 80 units minimum, right? So sticking in that 25, 30, 40 units, it seems like there's a little bit more upside on those.
Yeah. And like you said, there's not as many people. You're kind of that, you're in that space between mom and pop and institutional money or large syndications.
Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like you're leaving some meat on the bone on that. One of the problems that people run into in those is that they are too small for an experienced property management company to take it over. How have you overcome that hurdle?
This is another pro tip, you know, so people should follow this one. I partner with property managers. So I have two partners. My partner from Old Fashioned Real Estate, Brian, he owns a property management company. And my other partner in Michigan owns a property management company, Travis. They're also really good friends of mine. But I feel like if you partner with a property manager, you have really aligned interests.
What's an effective strategy for doing that?
Yeah, you just got to know the right people, I guess. I don't know. I'm not good. I've been so lucky in my partnerships I'm super blessed in that. And I think it's just because I partner with people that I like. That's right. Really my strategy. Like, I want to partner with people that I know and trust.
Sure. Sure.
It's risky though, right? I mean, there's the risk that if the partnership goes bad, you might lose a friend or something like that, but it's worked for me. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you're going to start with people you like. I mean, if you don't like them, then it's doubtful you're going to do business with them. But I'm thinking more in the strategy of how did you set up the arrangement as a partnership? What does the property manager, what part of the deal do they take? How do you, what's the structure of that like?
Yeah. So, I mean, these are like real partnerships, right? So we form an LLC, we own it together, and then we contract with their property management company on similar terms to what they would charge anyone else to manage a similar property. So we're actually partners. We're in it for the same amount of money. We, you know, 50-50, 130 each, stuff like that. And then we just, we let them charge their regular management fees, whatever they would charge someone else for a similar property.
Is it possible to fire that property management company?
It's possible, but it would be very difficult, right? So in the case of some of the partnerships where I'm literally 50-50, it would maybe be impossible, right? But or it would require like lawsuits and stuff. And I don't think I want to go down that route. But on other ones, you know, we have other partners. We could outvote our property management partner, but so far we have not ever had to do that. And we haven't even come close. Like I said, it's worked out really well for me.
Yeah. I mean, again, you've picked the right partners out of the gate, which is the simplest way to, you know, keep things working without much headache.
Yeah. And we started small too, right? So that's the other thing. Like, you don't start a partnership with someone and go, okay, we're going to go buy a 40-unit building tomorrow. Like my partner in Michigan, Travis, like we started with a single condo, right? Like it was a $30,000 condo we each bought for cash, like I told you about. And then from there, we built up the portfolio to about, like I said, 50 some units. And then eventually we started buying apartments. So the first apartment I bought with him was 19 units. And then we bought a 32 unit after that. And then after that, we just kept buying them. So.
Wow. Wow. What does the future look like for you? Like what does success look like for you in the next 24 to 36 months?
Yeah. So this market is really strange right now. I mean, at the beginning of the year, I really felt like I wanted to buy 400 units this year. So both of my property management partners and I, we do some stuff, the three of us now. We set a goal of buying 400 units, but now I'm not so sure. I've got 46 this year. So, I mean, I'm not doing terrible, but we're one quarter into the year and that's less than one quarter of 400. So we're behind that pace and we'll see what happens, but I'm not going to push it. So I'm just going to, I only believe in doing deals that work under my model, right? So, I mean, we got to be very disciplined about that, especially now that we do a little bit of syndicating. I mean, we do super small syndications. In those, we might raise $500,000 or something. Got to be really, really, really careful with other people's money, even more careful than we are with our own.
The super small syndications, why are you moving to that model?
Because we want to grow. So we won't like, and we feel like you got to start somewhere, right? Like you got to start at some point. So we started with a couple of small syndications, and I think we've done five now. Similar, each one a little bit bigger than the one before. So sort of step strategy, and it's the same reason I think you start with like a single family house instead of buy an apartment complex out of the gate. I feel, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So if you start small, you're minimizing your risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So your intention then would be to grow your investor base so that you could then take down yet larger deals.
Yeah, actually we can. I mean, we have a lot of people that want to invest and we're turning people away right now because we can't find deals that fit our strategy. So the money is not really the issue at the moment.
That's interesting. I mean, there's so many people in this business that the capital is what holds them back. And for you,
I've been there too, though. Right? I mean, it's one or the other, I think, all the time.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's the capital. It's one or the other. But for you, it is your selectiveness in what you want to purchase that is slowing you down. And that's good, I think. You know,
well, it works for us. And it comes down to the fact for me, I'm comfortable with not being the richest person in the room, right? Like I'm okay with that. Like it isn't about riches for me. It's about freedom, like in buying my time back. If I wanted to do really big deals and like really stretch on that, which I do, I just want to do it in my own time. That's what it comes down to. If I wanted to do it really fast, then it would be, you know, I'd be taking more stress and I'm not sure that's the way that I don't think I thrive under that. I mean, I do fine under pressure, but I just don't want to, I want to be content with where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no amount of money in the world that can buy contentment. So, you know, why?
Yeah. Why? And I mean, like last year I took a month off and went to Africa. I'm glad I did because I did it before the coronavirus, right? I spent the entire month of February in Africa, came home and they shut the whole world down. And, you know, having the freedom to take a month off is, it's pretty amazing, actually. Like I barely checked my phone the whole time.
Wow. Wow.
And I went to China in 19. I probably brought the coronavirus to America. I didn't know about it then, but, you know, I hope I didn't. I don't think I did, really. I'm pretty confident I didn't. But yeah, I don't know. I like to go 2-3 times a year somewhere on a big exotic vacation and see some stuff and experience the world.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I forget who said it, but they said collect memories, not things.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah. So living life on your terms, man, that's fantastic. I love that. I love that. What are some things that you feel like maybe that you could have done better over the years that are lessons, like hard lessons you've learned?
Yeah. I mean, listen, the lesson I learned twice is I should have done it sooner. The first one was I should have invested in real estate sooner. If I had started investing in real estate when I first started reading and learning about it, I wouldn't have ended up bankrupt. I mean, I don't regret it because you can't go back and change it anyway. But if I were to do it again, I would start investing sooner. And then the next one is the real lesson is I would have started multifamily sooner because the model is unbelievable. This value add strategy where you can pull all your money back out in, you know, 24 months or less is unbelievable. It's really, really crazy. And it works so well. And it honestly produces more income than the cash flow in a lot of ways.
You would have started multifamily sooner. Anything else, you know, maybe ways you did deals, you said, man, you know, that didn't play out, or that was a mistake, or a lending mistake, or.
Yeah. So when we did our it wasn't our first apartment, but we did our first non-recourse loan. We did a Fannie small balance, $1 million loan balance thing. And we didn't really understand how prepayment penalties work. Like we knew generally what they were, but we got into a yield maintenance deal, 9.5 years of yield maintenance. And so we have just tons of locked up equity in this property because the refinance cost would be like $500,000 or something stupid like that, even though we only owe like $900,000, right? It's because the yield maintenance, if rates go down, the prepayment goes up. And so rates have gone down a lot in the last 3 years since we bought that property. And so it's pretty brutal. And it doesn't go away for 9.5 years. I mean, it goes down every year because the way yield maintenance works is it's like an expectation. So they basically take, if you pay it off early, they take the money you pay off and they reinvest it at the 10-year treasury or 9-year treasury, whatever the duration of the loan is. And they take that interest and they give you a credit for that interest, but then you owe the rest of the interest for the loan anyway.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's a really, I mean, you can get a really low rate if you use yield maintenance, but if you think you're going to refinance or if you're going to sell in that period of time, it can be very brutal. The loan broker we used at the time didn't really explain it to us. He was like, oh, well, if you want to save like 0.5%, you could do yield maintenance. And we're like, okay. You know, he's like, it's a little different way to calculate the prepayment penalty. And we're like, oh, that's fine. And then this is one of our first deals, really. So we didn't have we hadn't really refined in our strategy of refining every, you know, in 24 months and pulling all the initial capital out. So we had 1031 into this deal thinking, oh yeah, we're going to keep it for 10 years. So what do we care about the prepayment penalty, you know, all this stuff. But in retrospect, that was a mistake. The property we owe about $900,000 on it now, and it's probably worth 2.4 million. So that's like, you know, like 40% loan to value, and we can't refinance it.
Oh man.
Yeah. But cash flows really well as a result of that. So there is that.
But I mean, how painful is that to know that one, you could get a bunch of cash out of it, or two,
put that somewhere else, right?
Put it somewhere else, redeploy it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the loss on that. If the guy would have just, you know, told you up front, hey, it's 0.5 point.
Yeah, no, we would definitely do it differently if we did it again. So yeah, if people are getting non-recourse, make sure or any loan product, really, make sure you understand the prepayment and how it works.
Yeah. And those are things that I bet loan brokers don't.
the good ones tell you about it. I mean, I have ones now that I really like, but sure. But this was the broker that was selling the property was like, oh, it's a great deal. And like, we have this non-recourse lender already lined up that's pre-vetted the property. And we're like, wow, we don't have to sign a personal guarantee. Like, now I'm less afraid of personal guarantees now too, as a result of that. I'm like, you know what? Like, kind of, I like terms are more important to me than whether I have to guarantee the loan, because I'm going to pay the loan. Like, so the guarantee doesn't really matter, right? Like, if I'm going to pay it anyway, who cares if I have a guarantee out there?
Right, right. Yeah. And I don't know, you know, when, at what point in time, you know, that the scales tip in favor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd have a hard time personally guaranteeing like a $50 million loan, right? Like, cause that could bankrupt me and I don't want to go bankrupt again. Like that's, you know, that's just not something I'm interested in. But, you know, I kind of look at the stuff where you get to a certain scale. If you guarantee a $1 million, $2 million loan, and you've got, you know, several properties that could theoretically support it. If you did have a problem at one property, you just have to take resources from a different one to cover the loan until you got it straightened out.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's the flexibility, I think, of a non-syndicated model.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's, most of our stuff is still non-syndicated. So.
Right.
So we have that flexibility.
Right. And I think that's something that people overlook in the syndication space is that flexibility where you can go, okay, we can borrow from here to cover that if there's a problem. But in a syndication, it's its own company, its own business with its own set of investors. So there's just no...
Yeah. You really can't commingle the stuff at all, right? I mean, it's true even with... it doesn't even non-syndicated. Like I have some partnerships where there's three of us and others where there's just the two of us. Obviously, I can't take money from three people and give it to the two people. That wouldn't be fair either. So there is still that issue, but it's also easier to make a decision like to distribute extra capital. Like if you have a reserve account in a partnership and you say, hey, you know what? We have $100,000 in emergency money in this partnership. Like, and the three of us happen to own another property that has a problem. Like, let's go ahead and take the money, right? But even if it was just the two of us that owned the other property, we could literally say to our other partner, hey, like, we're going to distribute $60,000 and we're each going to get 20, right? And then we go take the two of us would take our 20,000 each and put it into the other deal.
Right.
And then the other partner would just have the benefit of having the 20,000 in their checking account or whatever.
Right. Right. Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Jeff, let's jump here into the final four. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Just invest. Just do it. Like, don't wait too long. It's so easy to wait too long.
That's good. I like that. What is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Listen, I track all deals that I look at and I check, even if I don't buy them, I find out what they sold for and put them in a spreadsheet, like a report card. So I can look back quickly and say, wait, why did I miss this deal? Like if it sold for less than I would have been willing to pay, then why didn't I buy it? Or if it sold for more than I'm willing to pay, I want to know why somebody thought it was worth more than I did. What did I miss? Or did they make a mistake? And I just keep that spreadsheet, just a constant tally of everything I look at.
Wow. That's impressive because there's a lot of deals out there and a lot of stuff coming across your desk, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, only if I do a full underwriting though. Like if I just look at it and go, no, that's not for me. Because there's too much of that. Right.
Okay.
But if I actually put it on a spreadsheet and like, I've already spent time on it to know enough about the deal to where I have real information about it, then I'm going to keep that in a separate spreadsheet. I'm just like, here's a summary of everything I'm doing.
Right. Right. Absolutely. No, that makes a lot more sense. I thought you were tracking everything that you ever look at.
Yeah, that would be very difficult. I mean, sure, somebody probably does it. It makes me look lazy, but I'm lazy then, I guess.
No, man. I think you're doing pretty good. All right. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah, that's what I do with Last Life Ever. That's my other podcast. We just try to help people live the best version of their lives. We started a foundation, so we do things like charitable things, especially small charitable acts that slip through the cracks of the bigger things. So like, last year, we paid for tuition for a six-year-old kid in Tanzania. We do things like we actually paid to fix a taxi cab driver in El Salvador's car because he couldn't work because his car didn't run. You know, so when things come across our desk, people make nominations and stuff to us. We say, oh, okay, this is the kind of stuff that I always loved doing personally. And now we do it through the foundation. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Jeff, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah. If they want to talk about real estate or something like that, Instagram at Jeffrey Holst is probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. But I mean, I'm everywhere and everywhere I'm Jeffrey Holst. So Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, doesn't matter. And obviously we have the Old Fashioned Real Estate Show which is pretty fun. Like, we get drunk and talk about real estate, so they can follow me there as well.
That's awesome. Jeff, thanks so much for your time today. This was great.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.